It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Facebook says it's working on a version of the photo sharing app Instagram for kids 12 and younger. We'll look at why Facebook says it's developing that platform and how the idea is being received. First, under a proposed 10-year plan announced last week, the U.S. Postal Service would raise rates, see longer delivery times for some first-class mail, and play a bigger role in the package delivery business. The USPS also aims to find savings of about $160 billion. The plan has already gotten some pushback in Congress, but Postmaster General Louis DeJoy defended it as a realistic way to maintain service at a time when Americans are sending less mail. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the potential for some slower long-distance mail delivery or higher rates in the future? Do you think it's important for the Postal Service to at least get close to breaking even financially? Do you count on the mail on a regular basis for yourself or for your business? Do you work for the Postal Service? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jacob Bogage is a business reporter covering the U.S. Postal Service for the Washington Post. Jacob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you.
Before we dig into this plan, Jacob, can you give us a sense of the financial position that the Postal Service is in right now?
Bad. Is the way I would describe it. The Postmaster General's plan is to make up for $160 billion in the next 10 years. And that's for one main reason, which is we're all sending less mail. Sending tens of billions of pieces fewer now than we did in 2008. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers in front of me here. I just pulled them up. We sent 92 billion pieces of first-class mail as a country in 2008. We sent 53 billion in 2020. That's how the Postal Service makes its money. It doesn't get money from taxpayers. It makes money from the sale of postal products and the folks who use the Postal Service. If we're not sending mail, the agency can't make money. It can't support this large unionized workforce. And it makes it more difficult for them to maintain their infrastructure, which is all over the country to serve all of us. And so that's the root of their financial issues.
Let's look at some of the changes in this proposal. First of all, some changes in the service commitments when mail arrives. Can you talk through what that commitment is now, what would change under this plan, and why it would save money?
Sure. So let's talk about what the Postal Service is supposed to do rather than what it actually does. So no matter where you live in the country and where you're sending mail, it should reach its destination in 1 to 3 days. Under the new standards, 70% of that first class mail is still going to take 1 to 3 days. If we've got to go more than 930 miles, it'll take 4 days. If we've got to go more than 1,900 miles, it'll take 5 days. So for that last 30% and change of the first class mail that's being sent, so that's mail that's coast to coast or going to Hawaii or Alaska from the mainland or Puerto Rico, we're going to take some more time to deliver that mail.
And
what this is...
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rob, go ahead.
The savings there, as I understand it from your reporting, is that mail that's going a long way. If I'm the Postal Service, now I could put that letter on a truck instead of on a plane, and trucks are cheaper than planes. Do I have that maybe oversimplified, but about right?
No, you do have that right. You absolutely have that right. I mean, what I was going to say, and this is fits right in, is that these new, what we call them service standards, these new service standards are just an acknowledgement from the Postal Service that, look, we haven't been delivering your mail in the time frame we're supposed to do it in a long time. So we're just going to make things more realistic. We can't go from New York to Los Angeles in 3 days unless we're going to put mail on a plane. And even then, we still might not make it on time because we're having problems with our network. So we're going to tell you, we're going to change your expectation. It's going to be 4 days or it's going to be 5 days now. And in so doing, they're also hoping that's going to save them some money by not having to lease space on cargo flights or charter planes themselves.
then some cost increases for the mail we send and for packages. What is in the plan?
We really don't know, actually. And this is the part that for all the folks that I talk to in the mailing industry really gets them ripping their hair out, because the Postal Service has the authority to raise postage rates 9% per product. So that means your package is going to cost 9% more. Your stamp is going to cost 9% more. You're getting your newspaper delivered if you get it through the mail, 9% more, things like that, which means a lot of those prices are going to be pushed to the consumer. Instead, you know, if you buy something from Etsy and it costs more to ship, your Etsy vendor is not going to swallow that cost. They're going to pass that cost off to you to get it to you. But the Postal Service, and I had an interview with the Postmaster General, mm-hmm. won't say how much they're going to actually raise prices by. They have the authority to do it up to 9%. They won't say if they're going to use all 9% or less. So that'll be something that we learn at some point this summer.
We're talking to Jacob Bogage, business reporter with the Washington Post, about a new plan from the U.S. Postal Service. Not a done deal yet, but a 10-year proposal to raise revenues, cut costs, and make some other changes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jack joins us now in Lafarge. Jack, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm listening to this, and I want the person to address this. The guy who's running the post office is a Trumper, and he's anti-union. And we know that back in the, I don't know, it was 2008, 2007, the Republicans made a mandate that they pay pensions out for 70 years, doubling things. And what it does, it has been making the post office, how you call it, not competitive. And therefore, all these things that they've been doing have been making it non-competitive to bust the union. And this has been going on for how many years? And it's
Jack,
not really that they're running deficits.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. So, Jacob, let's start with that point about the pension funding that is, I think, one element of this plan. Can you talk about that situation that Jack's referring to?
Yeah, what Jack's talking about is the Postal Service. He got the year right, too. 2006 law that kind of remade their finances requires the Postal Service to pay its retirees' health care costs up front instead of paying by year as those costs incur. And it costs them about $5 billion a year. Now, here's the catch. The Postal Service hasn't made those payments in a decade. So when you look at the Postal Service's balance sheet, it looks really ugly. Like, we're talking about 2020, they lost $9.2 billion a year. Looks really ugly. Half of that is from the retiree health care funding, and they didn't pay it. So it looks really bad, but they haven't had actually any cash going out the door. So when we talk about the structural problems for the Postal Service, a lot of people like to talk to me about the retirement health care pre-funding. And yeah, that's a big issue. And getting that obligation taken care of would help a lot of people who run the Postal Service sleep easier. But that is not the biggest problem facing the Postal Service, for the main reason that they don't even pay that money, and the Treasury and Congress doesn't even hold them accountable for that money. They know they're not good for it.
And our caller referred to Louis DeJoy, who you talked to recently, a Trump appointee, and was under a lot of political fire for changes he made, instigated last year, concerns about delivery of the mail during the elections last year and the holidays. And then can you talk about calls to replace him and why that might be harder to do than some normal presidential appointees?
Yeah, that's because for all intents and purposes, for a lot of people that I talk to, Louis DeJoy is a Trump appointee. He actually wasn't. He was appointed by the bipartisan Board of Governors from the Postal Service. But all of the members of the Board of Governors, even though some are Democrats, were appointed by President Trump. President Trump and then Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, leveraged the Postal Service's finances. They basically said, we'll let you go bankrupt. We'll make sure you can't pay your employees or deliver the mail unless you hire the guy we want you to hire. President Biden doesn't want to play that game. He wants to run the agency, you know, more above board, as some of my sources have told me. So he doesn't have as much leverage or doesn't want to use the same kind of potentially improper tools to reshape the leadership of the Postal Service. And so that requires him to work with the Senate to get more governors confirmed to the Board of Governors. He already has three nominees. Their hearings will probably be at the end of April. That's where, if there is a push to remove Louis DeJoy, the postmaster, it'll have to come from them. It can't really come from Congress, and it can't come from the president.
We're talking to Jacob Bogage right now, Washington Post reporter covering the U.S. Postal Service, looking at the proposed 10-year plan that could save $160 billion over a decade. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of these changes? Would you be willing to pay a little more for stamps for the occasional mail that you send? Or if you're in a business that involves sending lots of mail and packages through the Postal Service, what would that mean to you? How about less commitment to shorter delivery times, especially at longer distances? Do you work for the Postal Service yourself? Love to hear your perspective. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jacob Bogage, Washington Post reporter covering the U.S. Postal Service, about a new 10-year plan from that agency, some slower delivery time commitments, higher rates, among other changes. We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Philip calling from Eau Claire. Philip, hi.
Hello. How's it going today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Philip?
Well, I used to be a reporter, and years ago I was doing research on the post office, and I'm not going to go into all of it, but the question that I have always raised in situations like this, they say that they're losing X amount of dollars per year. The point they never make, though, is how much are they actually making in profit? Because I know there was one year the post office had said they were going to be losing like $1 to $2 billion in revenue, but yet they were still making over $10 billion in profit. To me, that's a little misleading.
Philip, thanks for the call. Is it a situation in recent years, at least, Jacob, where the Postal Service has been seen declining revenues but has still come out ahead of the game with some profit?
Yeah, no, that has not been the case. And they haven't turned a profit since 2006. I mean, they're in a tough situation where, as mail volumes decline, their costs are still high because they have a huge workforce, 644,000 people, 500,000 when unionized. They have to pay into pensions and healthcare funds that we talked about just a minute ago. And they have the sprawling national infrastructure, which is great for the individual consumers and businesses and folks who get their prescriptions in the mail. And, you know, there's a lot of people who need that infrastructure, but it costs a lot to maintain. And that has kept them from turning the profit.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Sean next in Stanley. Sean, hi.
Hi. I guess I was kind of wondering if there had ever been a consideration or an option to treat the U.S. Postal Service the same way we treat police and fire, where there's potentially like a municipal or city or state tax that maybe doesn't fund it completely, but helps shore it up, you know, especially with, you know, mail-in ballots being an issue. It would be a good way to make sure it's a safe, secure system.
Sean, thanks a lot for the call. So in effect, treat the Postal Service like any other government agency that you don't expect to break even on its own terms. Jacob, is there talk of that?
Yeah, there is. And I'm going to answer this Sean's question, which is a great question, in two ways. The really nerdy answer is that the Constitution gives the power to establish post offices and post roads specifically to Congress. And so it's a federal thing. Your town can't like run its own post office, for example. The larger question, and I think this was kind of the bulk of what Sean was asking about, was, should we just treat the post office like the federal, you know, any other federal agency? We don't expect our police to make a profit. We don't expect the Department of Defense or, the National Park Service to turn a profit, right? I mean, they're services. And that is the root of the question that the Postal Service is facing about its future. Right now, it is supported not by taxpayers, but by the sale of postal products. And it has to do that by, it's not a choice it's making, it has to do that by law. So does Congress, you know, if Congress wants to make changes to the Postal Service and wants it to be run like another federal agency, a service to the American people, is it willing to make that change and have us taxpayers support it? That's a question for your congressman.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about the future of the U.S. Postal Service, new 10-year plan out there. Jacob Bogage is with us from the Washington Post. Back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, throughout history, more or less, the urban postal patrons have subsidized the rural patrons because obviously it takes more money to bring a letter from New York City to North Dakota than it does across Manhattan. And what would be the consequence? And that is what I'm concerned about, the consequence of essentially cutting back on service and increasing costs. The rural recipients who have, you know, historically really been subsidized would take a big hit. And given I hate to use the word attitude of the postmaster, but he tends to favor private industry, I would say. I think it's a fair statement, as opposed to government services. If there is a drive to essentially make the post office non-competitive with, let's say, UPS or FedEx, you could end up in a situation where rural residents were in very serious problems getting their medications, voting by mail, whatever it is. I'd be interested in your comments.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. A couple points there. Let's start with the main one, Jacob, the impact on rural America.
Well, first of all, I just want to commend your caller. That was just a wonderful and succinct description of a lot of the fears that people have and a lot of the things that I hear about in my reporting. Yes, I mean, the consequences of this 10-year plan, which I should say is not just service cuts, right? I mean, it's talking about opening new, installing new package sorting equipment, buying a new fleet of postal trucks. I mean, there is investment here. But in terms of service specifically, yes, the brunt of those impacts are going to be felt by folks in rural America who will essentially be paying the same amount for less service. Me sending a letter to my mom who lives a few miles away from me here in suburban Washington is not going to cost, the service standard, that's not going to change. For folks who live in rural areas, and Rick mentioned some great points, especially about folks getting their medications, especially veterans, and folks getting bills. I mean, I had a story a few weeks back about folks who are getting late fees and getting dinged on their credit scores because their bills aren't showing up on time. And now we're just going to add more days onto that service standard. Yes, the brunt of those impacts will be felt by people in rural America.
Our caller mentioned another point, competition with UPS and other package delivery. That's something we haven't gotten into, Jacob, that is part of this plan. Louis DeJoy, it sounds like, wants to get more of a share of the package market in the U.S. What's he talking about?
Yeah, and there's a good reason for that, which is that even before the pandemic, package volumes for the Postal Service were soaring. Again, 2008, the American people sent 3 billion packages through the Postal Service. In 2020, they sent 7 billion. 2020 was the first year that revenues, not profits, but revenues from packages exceeded revenues from first-class mail. That's huge. And so that tells you kind of where the Postal Service thinks the market's going. You know, talking to Louis DeJoy, their projection is that package volume is going to increase 6 to 11% every year from now through 2025. That's going to be the backbone of the growth in revenue. And they want to be more competitive with FedEx and UPS and Amazon. That is a reasonable, logical place to expect growth. It's also kind of betting the farm for the Postal Service on things that are not mail. And they're going to have to improve their workflows, improve their network, and prove that they truly can compete at the same level that FedEx and UPS, and especially Amazon, can achieve.
A related point, we heard from Pat in Middleton who couldn't stay on the line. Pat says Amazon subcontracts to the USPS to deliver packages. If Amazon gets some overflow, USPS workers take shifts, get paid okay. And Pat thinks USPS doesn't charge Amazon enough, a decent price. Do you know about that? What's going on with Amazon and the Postal Service?
Yeah, that's a great point. Pat's right. Amazon does subcontract with the Postal Service because the Postal Service has this really great network and they go and deliver everywhere 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. And Amazon doesn't want to have to go over the hill and around the bend to deliver your, you know, container of dog food and paper towels. In terms of the pricing for those packages, by law for the Postal Service, have to be profitable. Each individual delivery has to be profitable. Not in the aggregate, each individual delivery. So to the extent that they're not charging express carriers enough, I mean, I guess that's a subjective term, but they are making money on every single package delivery. Could they be making more? Potentially. But if you are going to charge more, you're going to see less volume. And we've already seen Amazon's hired more than 100,000 people in 2020. They've hired the size of a small city, right? Not a small city, a large city to their workforce, specifically to build out their distribution network so they don't have to use the Postal Service. So you're playing with fire anytime you suggest you want to raise prices on these private express carriers because you might drive away their business.
And Jacob, just in our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for next for the future of this 10-year plan?
I'm watching for the Senate confirmations of the three governors that to the Board of Governors that President Biden's nominated. I'm watching to see how much the Postal Service is going to raise prices. And I'm watching to see if package revenues stay up.
We'll leave it there. Jacob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
Jacob Bogage is a reporter covering business in the U.S. Postal Service for The Washington Post. He talked with us today about the agency's 10-year plan proposed last week that could reduce some services with the goal of helping it financially break even by the end of the decade. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the pros and cons of a possible Instagram app specifically targeted for kids. A psychologist joins the show to look at the idea and maybe with some advice for parents when it comes to handling social media. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. In the old days, you listened for your doorbell. Now doorbell listen for you. We'll look at the latest smart doorbells from Amazon and other companies and find out why their cameras are raising concerns about privacy. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if you have kids who are 12 or younger, they're technically not allowed to use the photo sharing app Instagram or many other social media platforms. But that may change soon. Facebook, which owns Instagram, says it's working on a version specifically for kids. The move was first reported by BuzzFeed News earlier this month, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg confirmed it during a congressional hearing last week. Here he is talking about the potential benefits of the plan.
I think helping people stay connected with friends and learn about different content online is broadly positive. There are clearly issues that need to be thought through and worked out, including how parents can control the experience of kids, especially kids under the age of 13. And we haven't worked through all of that yet, so we haven't formally announced the plans. But I think that something like this could be quite helpful for a lot of people.
Others criticize the idea, saying it's a way for Facebook to lure kids into its services and make money off them down the road. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the idea of a kid-friendly Instagram? Would you let your kids sign up, or do you think social media and kids are a bad mix? What protections or tools would you need in order to be okay with it? Do you see some value in having a social media platform where supervised kids can connect with their friends and not in the grown-up world of social media? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Domoff is an associate professor of clinical psychology and director of the Family Health Lab at Central Michigan University. She studies how technology affects kids and families. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, you think about these issues a lot, I know, Sarah, and while we don't have a fully fleshed out plan, what is your reaction at first to this idea of an Instagram type site oriented specifically for kids?
I think I have major concerns about whether or not the Facebook platform for kids, the Instagram Messenger for kids, would be appropriate for them, because we don't know yet what stipulations are going to be in place. And from what I know from parents and what they struggle with in managing their children's social media use is that it changes quickly. Restrictions or settings need to be updated frequently. It's hard to stay on track of all the risks. And there's so many different platforms out there that children are interested in. And it's just hard to keep up with it. And so there's a steep learning curve. And so when I first heard about this, of course, my red flags went off, because I know how hard it is for parents to navigate current platforms. And it's really going to be incumbent on the parents to navigate this new platform, which of course is going to be very challenging, because there's constant changes and, you know, we don't know the risks yet. And that's also what's really hard. We haven't done research on it yet. It's still in development. And so it's hard to even provide guidance on what the risks are for parents.
One argument I could see for this is, okay, there are kids out using the existing social media platforms now and running into grownups and all the problems that can bring, even for other grownups. Maybe if there's a separate site for kids with parents to supervise, one place that catches on, maybe it would solve some of those problems of keeping up with all those different pools of social media. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I think what can be really challenging, regardless of whether it's designed just for kids, or if it's, you know, what children are using right now, which is the, you know, regular Instagram or Facebook and other types of social media platforms, is that it goes beyond just, you know, having kid-friendly components. I think one thing that parents really struggle with is not just who they're interacting with on social media platforms, but when they're using it and persistent requests to get onto their mobile devices. And when we think about the risks for children when it comes to social media use, we care about what they're seeing, what content's being shared, who they're talking to, who they are messaging, who they're engaging with, as well as when they're using social media and digital media and their mobile devices. So in particular, there are many things that parents can do to mitigate some of the risks. But I'm yet to be convinced on, you know, the benefits of this for younger children.
Dr. Sarah Domoff from Central Michigan University, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology there. She looks at technology and kids, looking at an idea from Facebook, still in the planning stages, a possible Instagram site specifically for kids. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, reactions. And Sarah, before we go to our callers, given that there are so many social media sites, could you let us know what Instagram, the current version, is and how it works?
Yeah, so Instagram is largely a photo sharing platform. You can post photos, you can share content. It is required to be at least 13 to get on there, but we do know, and based on my clinical work and interactions with the families, children younger than 13 are using Instagram. So it's really image focused, so more so than Twitter. As you know, Twitter is mainly text, where you can share some images, but with Instagram, it's very focused on sharing images, photos, and videos.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Patricia is with us in Colfax. Patricia, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the air. I would like to say that Facebook has not had any real substantial oversight for all the years they've been in business. And I disagree. I don't think of it as social media. In a lot of ways, it's anti-social. And I don't think that Facebook should have another app for children. There's enough apps. There's enough going on. And a lot of times, like the person, your speaker, even said that a lot of people, children under 13, are using Instagram. So, like, I do not like the idea. Enough is enough. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these platforms need to have greater and more definite, substantial oversight. Thank you.
Patricia, thanks a lot for the call. Patricia, worried about the track record already of social media, doing big things, making changes, and not always looking ahead at the consequences, Sarah.
Yes, and I think she's right on the money there. This is a business, you know, this is a huge technological giant. So we have to be very skeptical of the motivations and really understand, you know, who's designing this? What's going into this? Are they going to be using features that really promote continued use, like we know that other companies do, to keep people on their apps? You know, with some of the concerns with social media, for even though, again, you should be at least 13 to use social media, there's advertisements, there's privacy concerns. There's a lot that we're trying to contend with. And I think if we want children to be in better communication with their peers, with their friends, with loved ones, there's other options that don't require sharing personal content or images online. For example, children can interact with each other through video chat, through FaceTime. So I think those types of opportunities to connect with others through like video conferencing or video phone calls could be really kind of get at that desire to connect with others, but again, mitigate some of the risks that come with sharing information online.
Thanks for the call, Patricia. We heard from Dave on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dave says we need unbiased research first. Only then, when the design is carefully crafted to benefit children, should it be allowed on a trial basis. Otherwise, no. What do you think? What kind of research, Sarah, would you envision on something like this that would make you feel comfortable having some kind of Instagram for kids?
I love that comment because I think what's been so challenging throughout all of this and just in my research studying technology and media is that, you know, we wholeheartedly adopt technology or apps or social media without considering the positive outcomes or benefits or consequences. And so I think it would be wonderful, and I think this would be amazing if there could be partnerships where we investigate the impacts of this, positive or negative. I want to hear from parents about what they struggle with in terms of managing the content, because I think one big piece is that because children and adolescents are accessing social media on their mobile devices, if they're not in the same room as their parents, or if, you know, we have busy schedules and we can't always be present when our child is on social media or on their mobile device, we can miss things. And we live in such a fast-paced world that it takes so much effort to navigate media parenting today. There's a lot to consider. And so I agree. I would much prefer to have unbiased research that would investigate this and really see, you know, does this actually make children's lives better? Does it make it better for them in terms of their social connections? Do they feel better about themselves? Are they learning something? And we know that depending on the content that children see online and how they engage with social media has an impact on the outcomes. And so we know that adolescents who just kind of passively scroll through social media, and engage in social comparisons, they do poorly. Whereas those youth who engage with their friends and talk to them and share support and use it in healthy ways can actually get benefits. And so you really have to know how to use these apps to get the benefit and to be protected from the risks. And so what I'm finding is that schools, parents, other community programs that implement some sort of education around how to use apps is going to be so important, because it's not clear yet. It's not like succinctly out there for parents to be able to pick up a guide and be able to figure out how to use these apps with their children in ways that are beneficial. So I definitely see a lack of information out there for those who really want to be involved.
We're talking about Facebook's plans for a version of Instagram for young kids. Sarah Domoff is our guest. She's an associate professor of clinical psychology and director of the Family Health Lab at Central Michigan University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to tackle our guest's question? How are you dealing with social media for your kids? What challenges do you face in keeping up with what they're doing, putting limits on it? Are there limits? Is it completely off the table? And do you have thoughts on the idea of an Instagram made especially for kids under 13? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Facebook's plans, still in the planning stage, to launch a version of Instagram for kids 12 and younger. Sarah Domoff is with us, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology and Director of the Family Health Lab at Central Michigan University. She studies how technology affects kids and families. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, and maybe your experiences in your family, whether you're the parent or kid in said family, when it comes to handling issues around social media. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to our calls now, our callers now. Spencer is with us in Fredonia. Spencer, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I don't think we need to worry about overseeing any kind of apps or overseeing anything. When I was growing up, it was my grandmother and my mother that taught me that calling people at 5 o'clock to ask if they could play was inappropriate because it was dinner time. The only thing that a parent ever showed me was how to dial numbers and remember my best friend's phone number. But nobody was putting, you know, sanctions on how my phone was used or regulations on how my phone was used. It was parents from the get-go. And so that's my thing is I think we're overthinking this. We're not going to socially stunt our child if we're restricting them from Instagram, you know what I mean, or restricting them from certain apps. As always, you just need to be, I think parental control is where everything starts. And trying to control it through the device or through the app, that's too big of a thing to manage. But if you're looking over the shoulder of your child, like you should as a parent, that's where the real control is.
Spencer, thanks for the call. Sarah?
Yeah, so I think a big part of what we do in my clinic is work through some of these parenting challenges. So how do we help children engage with their peers offline as well? So what are ways that we can promote social interactions and positive social skills development in real life, in real time, offline? And I do think that, you know, just as we would want parents to be involved in planning, like whether it be play dates or engagements, you know, face to face, whether it be through community activities, we have, in real life, you know, offline, we have parents and or adults present helping kids navigate challenges. And I think what gets really hard when we're online is that children may have conflict, but they don't have that adult there to say, hey, you know, that's not how we talk to people, or how are you going to solve this problem that you have with your friends? And so I feel like, you know, regarding the caller's comments, you know, it's really important for parents to be involved because children need to learn how to navigate these issues both offline and online.
Thanks a lot for that call, Spencer, at 800-642-1234. One challenge, though, Sarah, and you've touched on this a little already, Spencer and his family use the same kind of phone, maybe even the same phone line like I did growing up. But a parent might, you know, they might know Twitter and Facebook, but their kid's using Snapchat and TikTok, or throw in whatever combo, or the parent might not be a social media fan at all. So how difficult is it for parents to have that understanding of what the heck their kid's doing online in the first place?
That's a great question. And I think there's definite need for more education and support for parents around this. And one of the interventions that we've developed in my research team really teaches parents how to navigate these issues, because right now it's just not there. It's not easily accessible. And so one huge recommendation I have for parents is to, before giving your child a mobile device or giving them access to social media, is to have an agreement, a cell phone contract, a family media plan, something where your expectations are really laid out and you specify exactly what will happen and how you will resolve issues that may come up online. So you may experience conflict with a peer online. You may be asked to send something that you're not comfortable sending. Who can you go to get help for that? And what will I do, you know, as your parent to navigate this situation with you? Being very clear about that and open and having open communication about some of the risks that may occur online and what steps will be taken if such things happen can be very important, especially as children are getting access to social media at younger and younger ages.
Thanks a lot for that call, Spencer, at 800-642-1234. Sarah Domoff is with us from Central Michigan University, clinical psychologist there, talking about social media and kids. Sarah, an issue that seems to be coming up more and more is, you know, when I was 15, I could say something stupid and it was lost to the ages. Now teenagers are getting online and doing the same, maybe the same kind of things, but it's there forever. How do you train kids to watch out for long-term consequences of what they're posting online, and maybe how to be good bystanders for their peers at the same time?
That's a great question. We actually also really focus on that in some of our intervention work. And really, it's all about first helping teens, adolescents know about the risks, help them set up privacy settings so that only people they trust can see what they post. But it's also making amends if you make a mistake. You know, if you post something that's inappropriate or harmful or hurts other people, it's taking action to remedy, to fix the issue that you caused, and having your peers around you to also hold you accountable. So not being a silent bystander. So if you see someone online being cyberbullied or is the recipient of hateful speech, stand up for them, speak out, provide support. That's really critical. And I know that adolescents will make mistakes. This is how they grow. This is how they learn. But we need adults or other community members present with them saying, hey, you know, that wasn't cool. How are you going to fix this? What can we do so this doesn't happen again? And these are the consequences for your behavior.
In our last couple of minutes, Sarah, I think it's easy for a parent to give up and either say, okay, things change too quickly, I can't keep up, I'm going to ban social media completely, or I'm going to abandon any pretense that I can control it. A lot of what you have said today, though, seems like good rules of thumb that parents can apply regardless of the changing social media platforms out there in the world. What are some bedrock things you say to parents, no matter how the technology changes?
Absolutely. And so much of what we research and in the science behind this is based on what we know is important for children to grow up healthy and happy. And so one huge piece is you have to have open communication about what your expectations are online, what your expectations are for your child's behavior, just like you would regarding their behavior offline. So I really think if we can kind of take a framework of what would I expect of my child in real life, in person, and apply that to online settings, and making sure that those same rules and expectations and values that you have for their behavior in person translate online. And so one thing is communication. The second piece is having limits. So setting limits on when your child or adolescent can go online or, you know, use social media. So we see, you know, links between excessive types of social media use or other types of digital media use and certain risky outcomes, mental health concerns. But that link there is explained a lot by factors such as when the child is going online, when they're using phones. And so another big piece, in addition to talking to them about what they post and what they see, is helping them understand that there are times when we shouldn't be on screens. And when we look at the links between some of the excessive use of digital media and mental health concerns or physical health outcomes, we see a lot of that's mediated by disrupted sleep or taking time away from other important activities where we want our child's, you know, complete focus and attention. And so I think huge message is open communication. Make sure you're aware of the content that your child is seeing or posting online and have communication about that. And then make sure that you have designated zones or rooms or places in your home where there are no screens, such as the bedroom, such as around dinner time, when you have family interaction. So again, it's the content and the context that really matter.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Domoff is an associate professor of clinical psychology and director of the Family Health Lab at Central Michigan University. We talked through about Facebook's plans to launch a version of Instagram for kids 13 and younger and some wider issues when it comes to families and social media. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, presidents and the press often have a rocky relationship. We'll look at the Biden administration and the media, from the first presidential press conference to concerns about media access at border facilities. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. I haven't been keeping up with new movie releases lately, but apparently there's a big one coming out tomorrow, Godzilla versus Kong, raising the question that's plagued philosophers since the dawn of time. Who would win in a fight, Godzilla or King Kong? Now, you and I could argue about that all day, and we will. But what does the science say? A functional morphologist from USC tackled that question in an article at theconversation.com. Now, functional morphology is where you look at the parts of an animal and figure out how they work. The author says King Kong has some advantages, especially on land. His design actually lets him move around more like a human than an actual ape. That gives him a bonus in flexibility over Godzilla. But the giant lizard has a tail. It's great for balance and attacks, plus sharp spines in the back and gills for some reason. So that helps if the battle goes underwater. There's more to it than that, but the verdict, Godzilla gets a slight edge even on land. I once picked up a book about functional morphology cheap at a used bookstore. I thought it'd be cool to learn about that stuff. It was written for a much more specialized audience, like I think PhD students or something. Can't say I understood much of the text. There were some cool pictures and diagrams, though. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.